That we're hosting together with Professor Adnan Khan, our academic director, and with the help of Jemima. We're really happy to have Barbara Rambusek here today with us. She is director of gender and economic inclusion at the European Development at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the EBRD. You have the details. You had the details prior to this event, so I won't go long into her CV. But among other things, she's in charge of strengthening and expanding the EBRD focus on inclusion, both across its investments and also in their policy engagements. Barbara graduated from the University of Vienna and has a postgraduate degree, of course, from the London School of Economics and a CAS Business School. So we're ready to hear about her, about the journey she has had in integrating inclusion and gender in the EBRD's mandate and operations. It certainly has been quite a long road because when I was reading about your job here at the EBRD and the conversations we had prior to this event, Barbara, you joined the bank in 2012, but it was then just a pilot program for economic inclusion. And now that pilot program of economic inclusion has turned into a core part of the EBRD's mandate and operation. So we look forward to hearing your presentation. At the end, both Adnan and I will make some questions to you. So hopefully we can engage in a dialogue. And then the rest is all about our students that are going to be, I'm sure, very active asking questions and making comments about your presentation. So without any further comments, just to underline the fact that we're really happy and grateful for having you here today. And the floor is yours, Barbara. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Vanessa and Adnan also, and of course Jemima for supporting us and for welcoming me here today. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's always a pleasure to come back, even if only virtually, to the LSE and talk to students there who are going through the programs today. So today I will tell you a little bit about my experience at EBRD, how basically, I've worked with many colleagues across different teams to build this first idea of how could we better understand the impact of the European Bank's investments on people, how we can measure that impact, and how we can then actually help to maximize the impact and in a way support a transition of our countries of operation towards sustainable market economies that takes the people with them. And creates opportunities, access to jobs and skills and so forth for everyone. So maybe I share my slides. If anybody has any questions throughout the presentation, do not hesitate to raise your hands or maybe just speak. It's when I give the presentation, sometimes a bit hard to actually see people. So I can't see everybody at the moment. So if you want to say something, maybe just say it. That's absolutely fine. Even if you interrupt me, that's not a problem at all. So what will I tell you? I will first tell you a little bit about the EBRD and then why we focused on economic inclusion and gender equality in particular, what that means, how we define that, what analytical framework we developed, and then very importantly, how we made that relevant in the context of the EBRD. But then I will also give you a glimpse to the future. You know, we have come a certain way. We have developed projects and approaches, but the world is changing around us and new crises are hitting us, COVID being one of them, climate change, digitalization. There are all these big trends that are hitting the EBRD region as of course all regions globally. And we need to respond, we need to react, and we need to adapt what we're doing. So I will tell you a little bit about that as well and our thinking at the moment. And then of course, I'm very happy to answer any questions also about my personal journey in this context. So the EBRD very briefly was set up in 91 in order to support Eastern European countries, including former Soviet countries, in their transition from planned to market economies. Today, we stretch from Morocco to Mongolia and from Estonia to Egypt. So there are many countries that have joined to EBRD over the years. We invest roughly 10 billion euros a year across a wide range of investments. The vast majority are into the private sector, from industry, commerce and agriculture to financial institutions and also infrastructure investments. We are a European bank, but we are owned globally by a global shareholding. The EU is one of our shareholders, but our shareholding is all the way from Mexico, as Vanessa knows very well, of course, but also all the way to Mexico, Japan, well, to Canada, Japan, the US, Korea, etc. So it's an international bank with a European mandate and that has actually stretched into North Africa and all the way to Mongolia, as I said. So how did this whole idea of gender and economic inclusion develop? Where did that come from? It started actually before I joined the EBRD. It started with a Life in Transition survey, which is a survey that the EBRD undertakes every few years in order to understand what this transition process means for the people of our countries of operation in terms of their livelihoods, their economic opportunities, but also their perceptions of that transition process, both the economic process, but also the political and social processes that come with that. And I think in 2010, there was a bit of an awakening, because at that time, you know, there was still a firm belief that, well, the transition of these countries towards market-free, sustainable market economies must be positive for everybody. There must be something in it for everybody. There must be this sort of trickle-down effect. And I think what the Life in Transition survey showed at the time was that that was not necessarily the case, that life opportunities did not necessarily increase to the extent that had been expected. And that indeed in some countries, due to the lack of improving life conditions, there was actually an increasing lack of support also for economic reforms and for political, particularly democratic reforms that went alongside that. So we could actually see a stalling in the transition process due to a lack of a political mandate, because people did not feel that this transition process created the economic opportunities and in a way took them with them. On this journey. So there was then a drive to better understand why that was the case and what we as a bank could do to make sure that our investments would actually create better opportunities for everybody. So that in a way is what set it off. We then started to look at what does inclusion actually mean? How would you define economic inclusion? And we decided to focus on the concept of equality of opportunity. If you look at inequality more broadly, in a way you have different aspects of inequality. It is about inequality of outcomes, which is basically the income that you have available, but it is also about equality of opportunity. Equality of opportunity fundamentally describes the opportunities that are open to somebody based solely on the amount of effort that somebody puts in. So if you work very hard, then you will have better opportunities. If you study hard, if you put a lot of effort into achieving your goals and sort of being the best, really realizing the talent that you have to the best possible, in the best possible way, then there should be more opportunities that are open to you. In a way, that would be fair. There can, of course, be inequality in this context too. Those who work less hard will have less opportunities. But fundamentally, if it's all down to you and to your effort, that should be a fair type of inequality. However, that, as we know, is not always the case. There are many characteristics, many circumstances that impact on people's abilities to actually realize the potential they have, regardless of how hard they work, regardless of the effort that they put in. So if you are born to parents who do not value education, who do not make education available to you, then however hard you work, it will be much harder for you to achieve the levels of education that fundamentally and ultimately you need in order to succeed. Or if you're born in a very remote rural region in Tajikistan, your opportunities will be substantially different compared to if you are born in, I don't know, central Istanbul or in central London. In terms of what is open to you, the type of institutions, the type of educational institutions, but also the type of employment opportunities or entrepreneurship opportunities that surround you. Equally, gender is an important component. So we know, and I don't think I need to go a lot into detail here, but we know that gender has a huge impact on somebody's ability to gain an education, particularly in certain types of sectors and sort of skills areas, and then to translate that education into viable careers. And we all know about the gender pay gap, et cetera, et cetera. So these factors, in a way, are beyond somebody's direct control and yet have a huge impact on inequality. And that is, if you want, the unfair part of inequality. And that is what we wanted to focus on. So we then looked across our countries of operation and looked at, basically actually used a new iteration of the Life in Transition survey to better understand to what extent those characteristics that we cannot control impact on somebody's economic outcomes. And what we see on average is that up to 50% of income inequality across the EBRD's countries of operation is due to these characteristics that you cannot control, but that have a huge impact on your opportunities, regardless of how much you work, how much effort you put in. So gender and particularly place of birth and parental background were the three key characteristics, three key circumstances that we found that really shaped inequality of outcomes. So in the end, fundamentally, that gives you three target groups. So on gender, it's in the vast majority of countries, it is women rather than men. We then also, in terms of parental background, we looked at the point of entry into the labor market, where that parental background really shapes the extent to which you are educated, the extent to which you can access maybe tertiary higher education, and then ultimately make that all important jump into the labor market. And then the third one is place of birth. So we have fundamentally a focus on women, on young people entering the labor market, and then on underdeveloped regions. So that in a way started to formulate and create an analytical framework for us in this context. So where did the journey take us from there? As I mentioned, you know, we started with the Life in Transition survey. You can see all these many, many years, you know, from 2012 to 2021, 2022 now, it's a 10-year journey to date, where we have gone from having a very small pilot, which we developed at the start of 2012 when I joined, all the way to now inclusion being one of the key strategic priorities of the EBRD. Was there a question? Did somebody ask something? No. Okay. So we had, in a way, the principle that we understand that equality of opportunity can arise from circumstances that are outside of somebody's control. But how do you measure that? How do you know to what extent that is the case? What does that mean? Or how is that comparable across our countries of operation? Is it worse in Poland than it is in Romania? How does Turkey compare to Egypt and to Russia and Tajikistan? So we had to, in a way, find a way of measuring this inclusion gap or the gender gap, the youth gaps, etc., across our countries of operation in a way that was comparable. So we therefore started to look at what indicators we could use that would describe this gap. So when we looked at the gender gap, it's of course we compare men to women and we look at different dimensions and different outcomes that women may experience compared to men. So we looked at access to employment but also education, healthcare, entrepreneurship, finance. We looked at labor market policies, but also labor market practices. So very often it's not so much what is in the letter of the law, but how is the law applied or not. There is also lots of social norms that come into play in terms of how labor markets are actually structured. And then looked at the size of the gap between men and women. If in relation to young people, we looked at young labor market cohorts, compared them to older labor market cohorts, this sort of insider outsider challenge that is very often there. Again, in relation to the types of skills, but also how labor markets are structured in relation to allowing young people to enter into good jobs and have the right skills or set up on companies take advantage of entrepreneurship opportunities. Mm-hmm. And then in relation to regions, we looked at what is the discrepancy between the 20% most developed regions and the 20% least developed regions in the country? What is that delta? How big is it? And that gave us an indication of the extent to which a place of birth can actually have an impact on somebody's economic opportunities. And then actually comparing those data sets and using also harmonized data sets that would be comparable from the World Bank, FinDex, the UN, OECD sometimes, our Life in Transition Survey, et cetera, et cetera. We started to build basically an index, or actually three indices. Let me show you this here. This is the index that we built for gender. So if you look at the top, you see legal and social, legal regulations and social norms and health services, education, labor policies, practices, etc. And then on the right-hand side, down in that column, you have all our countries of operation, and at the bottom, you have some comparator countries to give us a feel for, you know, where is the frontier? Not that, frankly, gender equality has been achieved in any country in the world fully and completely, but at least to show what is the distance between, I don't know, Sweden in particular, and countries in Eastern Europe, Central Asia, et cetera. So that allowed us to develop a categorization from small to medium and large gaps. What this does, of course, is it provides a rough guide showing where are the gaps the largest, in which countries are what type of issues most prominent in relation to creating unfair disadvantages for women in particular. And so when we target our investments and our interventions, both working with our clients, but also with our policy partners, we can know which things, which issues to target. So that was a very important factor for us here. This is a list of the indicators that we used. I'm not going to go into all of that. I'm very happy to answer any questions. But fundamentally, you see, it's quite a wide set of indicators that we developed, sometimes actually using existing indices such as the SIGI or Women, Business and the Law, etc. By the way, we did the same for youth and for regions and later on also for disability and so forth. I'm not going to show you all of those, but just to give you a feel for the development of the analytical framework that we had. The EBRD then, of course, has a certain way in which it selects which projects to invest in. You know, we have a finite amount of money. There's a lot of need across the region. How do we pick projects? How do we prioritize projects? How do we know that this project in Poland is more worthy of our support than the other project in Turkey or the next project in, I don't know, Kazakhstan? So there is a project assessment process in place. It's called an ex ante, so an a priori project impact assessment process, whereby project applications or internal proposals are basically assessed actually by the Office of the Chief Economist, which is where I was also part of, or where there have been so many restructurings, but that's fundamentally where the department sat and still does. So to look at what is the expected impact that we see that a project can create? How does that compare to those inclusive gaps that I just showed you? Does it actually target a country where the gaps, say in relation to access to finance for women, is large? We have a women business credit line that targets female entrepreneurs. Are we targeting the right country? If we focus on Turkey, is the gap there larger than it would be, say, in Estonia? The answer is actually yes, it is. So okay, so then that gives us in a way a green light to proceed with that project. We then also need to not only understand that, but also the level of impact that this project will actually achieve in relation to the gap that we have identified. So here you see on the left-hand side, you see all these, what we call transition qualities that EBRD has. You know, we invest in countries that support or that transition towards becoming sustainable market economies, that they have certain qualities as sustainable market economies, and inclusive is one of the important qualities in this context. But we also, of course, support green investments, competitive, well-governed, integrated, and so forth. But inclusive is a very important quality. So we have our gaps. We then also look at the extent to which we can support our investment through policy. So to come back to the women in business credit lines, can we look at the regulatory environment? Can we look at what are the regulatory barriers that women may face in terms of setting up or growing their businesses, and can we engage in policy dialogue with relevant authorities to address those challenges. Then there's an integration to country and sector strategies. Is that project a priority, say in Turkey, where we want to have it? Is it mentioned in the country strategy as one of the issues that we want to tackle? And so forth and so forth. I think it's getting a bit sort of too detailed here maybe, but fundamentally, as part of this ex ante assessment, there are all these stages that we need to go through. And then ex post, of course, we want to understand to what extent did the project actually achieve what it was setting out to do. Did it do better or did it do worse than we thought, or did it do exactly what we thought it would do? And then, of course, all the way to evaluation. So then if we want to measure the impact, of course, we need to pick certain indicators. We have a compendium of indicators. We need to make sure that the indicators reflect not just sort of the activities that we do and the outputs that we can achieve, but also looking at what are the broader outcomes, what are the wider changes that we want to achieve. Coming back to the example of the women business programs, the impact that we actually want to achieve is of course that more women have access, more women entrepreneurs have access to finance, but actually we want to turn the market. By investing in partner banks in our countries of operation, we want to show them and make the case for them to lend to women entrepreneurs. We want to show that women entrepreneurs are a viable market segment. They're an underserved market segment, but they're a market segment that is actually quite low in risk and high in return. So there's the business case to be made for lending to women entrepreneurs. And that is in a way what creates the systemic impact for those banks to develop products, to develop services, and to start basically focusing on this market segment on a long-term basis and very much based on a solid business case. And that then creates access to finance and entrepreneurship for women in a much more sustainable way than if we just simply pay a bank to on-lend to, I don't know, 50 women, 100 women or whatever it may be. So we need to capture that sort of impact through the relevant indicators that we develop and that we have. Of course, we also undertake quite a lot of rigorous research that is, again, also housed in the Office of the Chief Economist, for example, to better understand gender bias in lending. We did some programs with partner banks in Turkey to understand to what extent there was actually unconscious or sometimes even conscious bias at play with loan officers when they receive an application. To what extent do they look more favorably or maybe less favorably at those submitted by women? How does the gender of the loan officer impact that? And interestingly, for example, women are actually quite a lot more critical of women applicants than male loan officers. So that can then feed also into providing that partner financial institution with a better understanding of how to train their staff, how to overcome this bias. Yeah, so I think there are of course always many challenges and ways to improve this way of measuring impact, but that's fundamentally what we're trying to do. The newest thing that we're now doing is, which in many ways is not that new, I think we're just a bit behind there, is we're developing a theory of change to really better articulate that journey from our investment to the impact that we can achieve at the individual level, at the company level, and then ultimately at the sectoral level. Okay, so in a way now we have come all the way, you know, we know what is economic inclusion, we can define it, we can even measure it across our countries of operation. We have integrated it into how we select projects, but actually what are those projects? So I've given you one example of a credit line for women, but of course there is a lot more that we can do. As I mentioned at the start, EBRD invests in 75% private sector companies across all these different sectors and regions, of course. But there are fundamentally three areas where we thought that by working with our clients, investing in our clients, we can actually create opportunities in relation to access to skills and employment. This is really where our clients are employers. Access to finance and entrepreneurship. This is the example I gave you just now where we lend to a partner financial institution, a bank, who then on lens on certain terms and conditions, targeting a certain target group. But then also access to services. And this is where our infrastructure investments come in. But that goes all the way from transport, connectivity, municipal infrastructure, all the way to ICT connectivity and the broadband and fiber optic cables in the ground. So these are the three key areas where we feel, or we felt at the time also, we can achieve impact. So how does this work? As I mentioned before, the impact we want to achieve is not so much we pay a client to hire women, or we pay a client to train some young people, or to extend the credit line to women. Excuse me. There has to be a reason for that company to want to do this. There has to be a business case for that company. Because otherwise, whatever we do will always be linked to our investment. And then, you know, they pay back. It's the end of the investment and everybody goes home and the impact is nil after that. So the sustainability of the activities needs to be there. That can only be there if there is a business rationale for the clients to do this. So we try to see, you know, to what extent do clients face challenges? Let's look at clients as employers. Employers need talent. In many industries, and I would say almost in all, companies stand and fall with the people that they employ. If they have people with the right talent who can produce whatever needs to be produced, but can also innovate, think, sort of be creative, drive the company forward, this is what creates competitive and growing companies in the end. So there's actually a lot of time and effort that a company invests in finding the right people, investing in the people, making sure that they have the right skills, upskilling, reskilling, and so forth. In many sectors, that is actually a huge struggle because we have, for example, in manufacturing. Who wants to work in manufacturing these days? Who wants to stand in a blue suit somewhere, you know, putting together whatever it is, cars in Turkey, for example? So these companies really struggle to find people who have the right skills, very often technical, vocational skills, and who want to be in this job, who can see long-term careers and progression routes in this job. So we can come in and actually support these companies to set a partnership with vocational schools or with universities to, in very importantly, particularly on the vocational side, to create permeability between vocational training and tertiary training, where you start with your apprenticeship, you get a vocational and technical skills background, but then you can actually progress into management roles and into tertiary education. So we do a lot of work like that with companies, and then complement that in a way on the policy side by bringing the voice of the private sector to shape national skills standards, national apprenticeship standards, national occupational standards that reflect the needs of industry in a given market. Meaning that, of course, on the flip side, if you look at the inclusion component, this creates access to jobs, to viable jobs, to careers for young people, for women, for people in less developed regions. So that's in a way the model. The same goes for the financial institutions side, which is what I just mentioned. We can actually enable banks to tap into new market segments that they hadn't thought about before, that they had thought maybe were too risky. There were some misperceptions about these market segments, particularly women, sometimes also regions, sometimes specific sectors. Young entrepreneurs is another area that we focus on very strongly here now. So by enabling these companies to tap into these markets, we also, of course, create access to entrepreneurship and finance. And then when it comes to services, it is about companies enhancing the number of people who use their services. This can be anything from bus services to railway. For example, if as a woman in Egypt, your chances of being harassed on public transport are about 95%. So if you are a train operator and you have CCTV, better lighting, if there is an awareness of all the people that work for you, the staff, about gender-based violence and harassment on trains, if there's an app where you can report when an incident happens, etc. So if there are all these measures in place, the number of women using the service is likely to go up. So this is in a way how we try to tackle these both things at the same time. Here are some examples. I've just given you many examples as well, so I don't need to go into more, but of course we also focus on people with disabilities and work with our clients to show that they are very reliable employees, that they invest a lot in in their performance, that they usually have very low turnover rates, very keen to also continue professional education and training throughout, etc. So we have a number of companies who have now really focused on that as well and integrated and focused on people with disability into their training, into their recruitment and outreach. So where have we come to? You know, we started with a very small pilot in 2012. I remember we had 6 countries and we started to mock rate potential projects, even though they didn't actually do anything. We just thought, how would we rate them if they did something? All the way to in 2020, we had 14 billion euros of investments in projects that have a specific focus on economic inclusion and gender equality as well. We have a very strong pipeline. You see the graph is sort of going up, but of course we would want to be much higher. We're currently around 15%. We actually want to go way beyond that, and I will tell you a little bit more about that in a moment. We also introduced for the very first time a gender scorecard target. So that's actually very exciting. So in addition to this focus on economic inclusion, we also have a very strong focus on mainstreaming gender across our operations to make sure that whatever activities we do, that there is an awareness of how those activities impact on women, and to make sure that if they create opportunities for women wherever possible. We now currently have just under 20% of our projects that have a gender component, but we want to actually double that over the next few years. So this is what we have achieved in terms of impact, number of people trained. You know, you see all these numbers here. It really ranges from creating access to training opportunities to the loans to business women receiving training support. But also, I think very important here, this is just an example, is about labor market restrictions in Central Asia in particular being dropped as a result of our engagement. Some further examples about policy engagements that we have launched from setting up sector skills councils in hospitality and tourism in Turkey, in Jordan, where we actually bring together the sector to look at human capital in the sector and better policies to make sure that the training that people receive in tourism schools is actually needed, is reflective of what is needed in the labor market. But we also have investment climate reforms with a gender lens now across Central Asia. In the Western Balkans, we've been partnering with the ILO to look at the COVID response, particularly last year, to make sure that that was done in a way that safeguarded livelihoods to the maximum extent possible. And that has actually resulted in changes in unemployment benefits, for example, in North Macedonia and elsewhere. I briefly wanted to also talk about gender mainstreaming. So as I mentioned, you know, we have a strong focus on making sure that gender is fully integrated into our investments, policy dialogue, but of course, all that being underpinned by institutional capacity building. So what we have done in this context is we're still on this journey, actually, to make sure that there is an understanding within the bank that gender equality is not just the responsibility of frankly, me and my team. Gender equality is everybody's responsibility. The bank has made a commitment towards mainstreaming gender across its operations, and that requires the active engagement and awareness and taking responsibility of everybody in the bank. Because my team is 30 people, 35 people, we can't be everywhere. We can't talk to every single client. We can't be in every single meeting. So there needs to be capacity across the bank for people to be able to understand how to build a gender component in, to know how to have that conversation with the client and to also raise this issue at the policy level. So we have introduced a range of different measures from a gender academy to having gender champions across all of our regional offices and banking teams. Of course, working very closely with our other MDB partners for the development of gender toolkits and events and awareness raising and guidance notes and all these things. So it's a very active field, but it's a field that, again, as I said, we want to scale up substantially. So this is in a way where we are, but where do we want to go? What's the future? So we have these two strategies. We have a strategy for the promotion of gender equality, and we have an economic inclusion strategy, and we're now updating both. We keep a specific focus on gender, which is distinct and in a way specifically focused on gender mainstreaming, but then we also want to substantially enhance and expand our focus on equality of opportunity. We reviewed, we had consultants who came in and looked at what has worked, what hasn't worked, you know, what are the basic lessons learned. Excuse me. And this, frankly, by the way, is hot off the press. So we've just presented this to our senior management last Thursday. So you're really seeing something that is really totally up to date with our current thinking. So we try to understand, you know, we have achieved a lot. We have increased the number of projects and policy and all these things. But what does it take to really scale this up to the next level? We're sort of hovering around 15, 18, 20%. How can we really scale up what we do? And here are some key points that came up from a survey that was undertaken with, I think, 600 staff internally. Gender inclusion is still seen as comparatively difficult to do. I think banking colleagues would rather talk about green investments or competitive investments, but sometimes sort of raising gender inclusive issues seems a bit difficult, or maybe they're uncomfortable because their sort of level of competence and confidence, I think, may not quite be there. We also have some issues with our internal rating system. It's quite restrictive. It really focuses on gender youth regions. That's it. And so if your project targets somebody else, that's tough. We at the moment can't really focus on that. There is a competition between those six qualities. Each project can only address two qualities. So if a project does already competitive and green, then inclusive is out. So there is this sort of internal vying for projects between teams, which is sometimes very unhealthy. And then, of course, we have many products and impact pathways, but we also know that there could be more. So there is really an onus also to develop further what we are doing. Of course, the world around us has also changed. We know that inequality of opportunity is a huge issue across the EBRD region. We also know that this 50% that I mentioned at the start of income inequality that is due to these factors that you cannot control, that is something that is still there. But that is in a way almost being overlaid by a number of mega trends that impact globally. That starts with digitalization, the future of work, automation. We know that hollows out labor markets, particularly at the mid-range, mid-skill levels, and reduces livelihoods, creates intergenerational inequality in many sectors, in many regions. We know that climate change has a huge impact on people in many different ways, from those that work in fossil fuel intense industries who have to transition out into sometimes unclear which other industries. So from coal away to what, you know, is the big question. But also we know that climate change and the effects of climate change impact on certain sectors such as agriculture that become no longer viable in certain parts of the world. But at the same time, of course, both digitalization and also climate change can create opportunities. There can be new sectors that spring up, new type of skills, new business opportunities, better connectivity to markets, you know, green skills, green jobs. There are growth areas in this actually as well. So there are pros and cons. Equally, urbanization is proceeding across our region, even though maybe not quite as fast as in the past decades. But regional disparities are increasing. Sometimes entire parts of our region, such as the Western Balkans, basically depopulating. There you have the perfect storm of low female labor force participation, high youth unemployment, and massive outward migration. So the actual size of the labor market is shrinking. How can you have a thriving, growing economy in that context? So there are real challenges that many countries face. And that, of course, is linked to migration and demographic changes. And that was all before COVID hit. So then on top of that, you know, you have March 2020, and suddenly the world is yet again another place. And the COVID crisis impacts on top of all the other issues, particularly again on women. And I'm sure you all know, you know, how COVID has impacted on women who have shouldered a disproportionate share of the care, the unpaid care very often, but who are also more likely to have dropped out of the labor market or have reduced their hours. And there is this shadow pandemic of increased gender-based violence. Young people have seen their education interrupted. This very difficult process of school to work transition has been has become even harder, even more slowed down. And of course, this entry into the labor market even more precarious. And then regions have seen sometimes their livelihoods being taken away. If you work in the Western Balkans, in Croatia, somewhere along the coast, and suddenly no tourists arrive, then the entire economy of that region really has fallen off a cliff. So, and also opportunities for migration suddenly disappear if nobody can actually leave their house. So there are all these issues and all these additional challenges that happen on top of what we have already been seeing. So we started to think about, what does that mean for us? What does that mean for how we think about our approach to economic inclusion, to equality of opportunity? What else can we do? And you see here some emerging thematic priorities where we look at green technologies, green jobs, green skills, but also green infrastructure and inclusive urban design, the digital economy, to really understand what are the opportunities, how can we support the opportunities by investing in our clients and also engaging in policy dialogue and mitigating against some of the negative impacts. So for example, the responsible use of artificial intelligence where it is appropriate and also to avoid the use where it is not. The future of work and skills is a huge area for us that we are actually undertaking a series of deep dives into at the moment to better understand what kind of skills will be required in across sectors, but also on a regional basis. How can we support our clients in a way to undertake a skills forecasting exercise and to bring their workforces up to speed with what is required to be competitive in the future? And then, of course, also to better understand inclusive regions, urban development, and this sort of public realm design to make sure that cities and services, utilities can be used by everybody. So when we come back to, you know, how do we define equality of opportunity in a way, going all the way back to 2012, we started thinking, actually, is it really only the things that happen at birth, you know, or does equality of opportunity actually change during a person's lifetime? And the answer that we are giving at the moment is yes. You know, we feel that there are actually these long-term stresses and shocks that really have a huge impact, even if, frankly, at the point of birth or even through your educational experience, you did not experience any disadvantage as a person. There can be things that happen later on that have a huge impact. That can also go in relation to gender. If we look at Iran in the 1950s and 60s, it will have been a different place for women to live and to realize the economic potential they have compared to the 80s, 90s, and today. So it's social norms can change. There are these sort of big mega trends can come, have a huge impact, but of course also fragility, conflicts can trigger crisis, as can health crisis that we experience at the moment. And our region is affected differently to, say, Western Europe or more developed countries, because the human capital resilience capacity is lower. If you fall out of, if you lose your job, the implications are worse. If you are in, I don't know, Turkey or in Tajikistan or in Bosnia, compared to Denmark or Sweden. So there is this discrepancy in a way also in this context. The prevalence of social norms is much higher in terms of what is actually an acceptable alternative solution for somebody, what kind of jobs are acceptable for women to take, but also for men. You know, if you reduce your salary or if you go into a job that's perceived as too female, then that is not really an option in many societies for men either. So we are looking at this, and this is in a way and for us to update this conceptual framework that we currently have. So in a way, we went back all the way to the basics to see what more can we do and how can we widen what we can do. So to summarize, what that means is throughout all this journey, and I'm happy to tell you a little bit about my personal journey in all of this, but the important thing is really to try and stay on top of what happens around you, what happens in the world around you, how does it change? And you can actually then translate that into how you operate, what your approach is, how you try to achieve impact. Another key lesson learned is that if you want to achieve anything within an organization, incentives are what counts, frankly. You get what you incentivize. If you don't put the incentives in place, there's a lot of goodwill and a lot of people have a lot of goodwill and all that. But when push comes to shove, it's what's in the scorecard. The third point really is about trying to find a niche where you create impact that plays on the unique strengths and capacities of the organization that you operate within. So it's not so much about emulating what others can do, and that will be whatever it is in the context of wherever you work and the organization you work in, but trying to find that USP, that unique selling point that is different, that enables you to achieve a certain type of impact, even if it is narrow, but it is there that others cannot achieve. And then basically don't take no for an answer, develop selective hearing, only hear the things that you want to hear. The number of times I've been told that things can't happen, or we tried that in 92 and it didn't work. It's like, okay. Just persevere, stay focused, take others with you, and not just the senior management. You need people from across the bank and horizontally and vertically from your organization. Create a sort of support network that can also sustain itself, because nothing always goes only well. There are ups and downs, and sometimes you probably wonder whether the whole thing is worth it, but stay focused. And and that's the journey I've been on so far. So we'll see where it takes me next. Thank you.
Thank you, dear Barbara, for such an interesting and insightful presentation. I enjoyed it a lot. I was particularly impressed by the conceptual framework you described, the methodology behind it, because that makes it a very, very serious, very part of the core of the institution, and it's something you can really measure, no? Mm-hmm. So that's something I would like to highlight. I have three questions, but I already see my students raising their hands. So of course I will, turn the microphone to them. So I'll just make one question. And I would like if you can let us know a little bit about the flavor of the politics of policies in this case. What has been the environment within the bank, but of course in an institution where you have 69 bosses or 69 owners across the 5 continents, that must have a lot of politics involved. So how have you handled keeping, these as a priority, these as being part of the core of the mandate and the operations of the bank? And I would love to hear a little bit of that. And then I'll turn to Carmine, Tangulu, Lucas, and Adnan also wants to make a comment. So I'll pass on the word. Perhaps I will pass on the word to Adnan, and then you can answer us both, and then we can just leave the floor to the students so they can take on forward.
Okay.
Thank you. Adnan, please.
Thank you. I agree that we should go to the students, but thank you for the privilege. It was a great lecture, great talk, very insightful. So, Vanessa, I mentioned about the conceptual framework. So my question is a little bit about the complementary part of conceptual framework. How do you implement it?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key challenges in policy is not just policy design, but implementing it. And one can come up with all kinds of key frameworks and concepts, but translating them into implementation framework is a big challenge. What you presented at the beginning was how do you translate these big goals into actual templates that people in the field and at the headquarters can follow to basically quantify, make judgments, compare, and take decisions. I thought it was very creative, very useful, something that we should all note. My question is also, you can come up with all kinds of indicators and templates. We also know that if you have a template or have an indicator, its value also decreases over time because people start gaming the system, and there may be all kinds of perverse incentives to manipulate the metric, but not the underlying measure. And I wanted to know your thoughts about, like, how have you thought about it? How have you thought about updating and getting the underlying measure and not just the reported metric? Yeah, thanks again.
Okay, thank you very much. These are very, very astute questions. So if I start with the politics, well, indeed. So we have at the moment 71 shareholders who have sometimes very different ideas of what should happen and what should not. Maybe if I go back to 2012, 2013, so I came along with this idea of inclusion together with the chief economist, actually, Eric Bergloff. And it was a very mixed response. I mean, this was not open arms. This was not the board saying, yay, the best idea. Interestingly, and I hope to not be quoted here, but there were some, say, Western European countries, quite a lot of them, who were like, oh, this is not the mandate of the EBRD. You know, this is, you talk about World Bank stuff. You know, we're going to lose our AAA rating. One of them said to me, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. This is not for us, you know. It was our countries of operation around the board who said, well, actually, I tell you what, we have an issue with youth unemployment. We have an issue with inequality. We feel that this is something we want to do. So there were some really, really tough negotiations. I remember it was July 2013, to actually get this through and to have a focus on inclusion being integrated into the mandate of the bank, which is the fundamental change we had to achieve. So this was by no means plain sailing. It went on the negotiations well into midnight ahead of the board meeting. And then at the board meeting, we had a very skillful, it was a committee meeting. We had a very skillful chair who managed to get it through. But it was touch and go, I would say. Since then, the world has changed as well. Today, when I go to the board, I'm pushed to be more ambitious. I'm pushed to do more, you know, on gender. Why can't we have 80% of projects with a gender component? Where are you on your 20%, you know, and so forth and so forth. So the challenge has become a very, very different one. But I'm actually very glad. I mean, I'd much rather be challenged for not having enough gender projects than having to justify why we do gender in the first place. So the world really has moved on, and in that context, that the politics have to. Now with the new equality of opportunity approach, the question will be, you know, how do you define the gaps? You know, how do you know that Estonia is doing better than Egypt and so forth? So we need to stick with that methodology. We will just look at slightly different indicators and actually look at more of a human capital development approach. But so the board engagement is important, but has changed a lot over time. How do you implement? Some things work and some don't, you know, as always in life. So we have some products that work really well, such as the Women in Business program, such as actually the whole focus on skills. We work with clients across I don't know how many different sectors to basically do workforce development with them. Equal opportunities to some extent, even though sometimes that is more appreciated, less appreciated. The challenge we have here is to try and capture systemic impact, because that's what EBRD is all about. So, but yet very often we get hung up, including sort of by the board focusing on, okay, so you have trained 200 women or 300 women or 400 women, you know, and to in a way assign impact on the basis of that. But actually, to be honest, what does that mean, 300 women versus 400 women in a country like Turkey? I mean, the challenge is really, and I think the systemic impact is that we're changing the behavior of a client to recruit differently, to look at its workforce differently, to introduce new policies and practices and so forth, and to create in a way a new institutional culture rather than train X number of women or Y number of women. You know, that's sort of in a way almost neither here nor there. So it's that's been a real challenge, and also something we try to address in the new strategy to get away from this individual level impact to much more systemic impact. So that's not always been easy. Gaming the system, yes, of course. you know, we're all human, and our banking colleagues are of course also human, and if they can get a few extra points here and there, they will try it. So over the past few years, we have had to automatize this transition impact assessment system. It's now all an online functionality, and there are these questions you need to answer. And of course, they run through 5 times and see what's my optimum way of answering these questions, and how can I get the maximum number of points. We are in the process of updating that more or less continuously every 6 months to kind of close these loopholes where we find them. A classic example for me is that on disability, if you have a program with a client that provides training, and you focus, say, on young people, and then you add an element on disability, it's a different target group. And then you have 2 scores, one for youth, one for disability, and you get the average. So actually, if you only do one group, you're better off, because even if you do a second group, one of the 2 ratings will always be lower, and then it always pays off to just go with the higher rating, because as soon as you go with 2, the average is lower. And even if both elements have the exact same rating, you could achieve the same rating if you just go with 1. So there's actually an inbuilt disincentive to focus on smaller target groups. And that's also reflected in the numbers. We have the vast majority of projects focusing on youth and women, and then very few on disability, very few on regions. So another thing we try to address now in the update, because that's exactly where you fall down in this sort of little loopholes that you don't think about at the start, but boom, then they sort of hit you.
Thank you so much, dear Barbara. We already have 7 students. So perhaps if you allow me, I'll give you the word, 2 of you, and then you can answer, and then again, two more. Yeah. So I have Carmine, I have Tangulu, Lucas, Paulo, Crystal, Fernanda, and Manuela. So Carmine and Tangulu first, please.
Sure, thank you very much, Vanessa, and a huge congratulations to Barbara for what I thought was a really excellent presentation. Let me just briefly introduce myself. I'm an economist at the World Bank, working extensively on economic inclusion issues, primarily gender, but also youth in a previous life. And I'm a student at the Executive Master of Public Administration program at LSE-SPB. So since the presentation was so interesting, provided that Vanessa allows me to, I'd like to ask 3 quick questions, if I may, Barbara. Because I have one kind of strategic slash political question, then a bit of a technical curiosity, and then sort of a higher level type of query. So on the strategic level, I wanted to piggyback a little bit of what Vanessa just said about the politics of economic inclusion. She focused on the internal politics. I wanted to ask you about the external politics, so the client-facing politics. And the reason why I'm raising this is that a lot of my work is about gender and sectors or topics that have been traditionally male-dominated. I do a lot of work on trade and gender, business environment reforms and gender, the diversity in the context of private sector development, etc. And one of the things that I struggle a little bit with is that, as you know, on the one hand, technical understanding on these issues vis-a-vis our client counterparts tends to be fairly low. And also finding the right narrative to solve these issues to our counterparts, it's not necessarily that straightforward. One narrative that I found to be relatively effective is around the economic case for gender equality, right? And how gender equality is smart economics. And that sometimes does fly, sometimes it flies a little less. And so I wanted to ask you whether there is one selling point that you might have found to be particularly effective when it comes to pushing these issues with your client counterparts at country level. Then the technical curiosity, and this is probably the technical nerd sitting in myself somewhere, is about women's economic empowerment, right? One of the most popular buzzwords these days in the economic inclusion space. And I think we haven't yet gotten to the stage of having one definition of women's economic empowerment and how to measure that. We're debating the issue fairly heavily internally within the World Bank. But again, I'm curious to hear from you whether you have your definition of women's economic empowerment and how you measure it. And then thirdly, and this is now me taking off the World Bank hat and putting on the hat of economic advisor to the Italian government for the G20 presidency. Gender and prosperity, more broadly speaking, is another big buzzword in this global debate about post-COVID-19 relief and recovery. And I think all of us are fairly engaged in this space, international financial institutions and other actors too. And I'm wondering how we could best use these various global platforms and fora that we have ahead of us throughout this very special year to maybe rally people and resources around one particular topic or theme or buzzword indeed that you think might be particularly helpful in terms of driving inclusive post-COVID-19 growth. My two cents is that that word might be parenthood in terms of liberating women from the burden of unpaid domestic labor and fully unleashing their economic potential as traders, entrepreneurs, consumers, and citizens, more broadly speaking. But I'm wondering whether you have any views about what that one topic could be that we could use on those platforms to reunite international financial institutions around it. But thank you very much. It was incredibly interesting.
Thank you, Carmine. And now Tangulu, and then Barbara, please.
Barbara, thank you very much for your presentation. I'll be specifically interested in the market of Uzbekistan, since I've been working there, and since it's one of the biggest markets, 34 million people in Central Asia, compared to Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan. And since it's very underserved market, as you already shown in your presentation, Uzbekistan lags largely behind. There is a huge gap for access to finance for women. Understanding that there is problem with a collateral ownership, like property rights for women in Uzbekistan, understanding that there is a cultural bias and credit bias, as you mentioned before, for women in Uzbekistan, I'd like to know if you have any like specific policy dialogues with the government of Uzbekistan, because we know that in Uzbekistan things work top down. Even for example, if in Kazakhstan things can work like horizontally, then we know that in Uzbekistan things can work only vertically, without any like top-down approach. When there is a specific order to do this way or that way, things are not going to move. So yeah, this is my question. Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Okay, so it's my turn again. maybe I start with the Uzbekistan question, since that just came back, and then I go back to Kamina's question. So in Uzbekistan, indeed, we have launched two things. First, we have a Women in Business program. So we work with a range of different partner financial institutions to lend to women and to provide advisory services and so forth, to provide a risk cushion to the partner banks to really develop these programs and target the women entrepreneurs market. In addition to that, we are also engaging with the authorities, and that includes the Ministry for Finance, the Ministry for Economics, but also Ministry for Labor, etc., and also the National Women's Entrepreneurship Associations, to look at an assessment of the regulatory environment in relation to women entrepreneurs, all the way from starting a business to growing a business to being able to access the skills that are needed. So this is actually one of our increasingly flagship programs it's almost like an investment climate reform with a gender lens. So we have a series of events now. We actually have a person now based in our office in Uzbekistan, to focus specifically and exclusively on that, and to really drive the policy engagement in this context. So we've been doing this now for a year or 18 months. So I can't yet sort of, there are no big successes yet, because as you know, these things take time, but it is firmly in our focus. What I should say is EBRD has only just recently started to re-engage in Uzbekistan. So I think it's now 3 years or so that we started to work again, 2 years that we started to work again in Uzbekistan, but our activity levels have actually increased very, very quickly. So including on the policy side. So this is an important country for us now. Okay, so then to the other questions. The selling point for gender in relation to our policy partners. And also our clients. Look, it doesn't always work. I have to be very honest. You know, we try and we succeed in many cases, and in some, you know, the client says, you know what, actually that's not for me. So we have to also accept that. Sometimes we then start with some very small activities that may not have systemic impact. We're just starting a sort of sensitizing approach, undertake a first gender diagnostic, this sort of thing. And in a way, the same goes at a policy level. However, at the policy level, the in a way, the killer argument, because you were asking, what's the killer argument, is very often the economic one. So in Kazakhstan, we brought the voice of employers, particularly in the energy sector, to show that for them, because very often they work in more remote regions, to actually get people to work, you know, if you only fish in half the talent pool, is very hard. So companies have to bring in people from elsewhere if they are not able to employ women in certain types of occupations. And there were 287, to be precise, types of jobs that women were legally not allowed to do. So we negotiated, we brought those employers to the table, the case was made, and I think it was, what did I say, 87 or so that were dropped. We are now actually in continuing discussions with the authorities, and I think there is actually an open door to just get rid of that list in the first place. So it's not easy, you know, it takes time, it requires continued engagement, but it is very often that private sector argument, in a way, that actually has been seen to be most successful. How do you measure, how do you define women's economic empowerment? What is your definition? I to be honest, I think this is probably one of the key questions if you look at the whole gender debate. Very often, you know, I remember I was asked, look at where, you know, the green guys are, you know, where are you on gender? With the sort of green investments, at least you have a unit, you have CO2 emissions, you have something that is fairly, it's still complicated, but it is clearer to some extent. When you look at people, when you look at, you know, certain target groups, when you look at women, it's much harder to really say what constitutes impact. How do you measure impact? What is the metric that we can all agree on? There are all these different efforts. There, I don't know if I'm sure you're linked into all of that also through the World Bank, but to in a way harmonize indicators across MDBs, and then at the gender level to come up with a set of standardized indicators that we can all agree on. So that we all measure the same, and so far we have failed, and I think that is a big failure, and is something that we really need to look at. So unfortunately, I can't give you a better answer, but it's the honest one. And then in relation to G20, W20, we've only just started to engage with them, so hopefully we will be part of the events that are coming up later in the year. I think you're right. I think one of the key issues, particularly now in relation to COVID and the impact that COVID has had on women, is the care economy. And it is the burden that has created for women in relation to childcare, elderly care, sick care, fundamentally the unpaid care that is not rewarded, and that actually holds people, women back from realizing their economic potential, even maintaining the extent to which they were engaged in the labor market or in entrepreneurship opportunities. So I think that would be a key one to focus on collectively, internationally, through the G20, through the G7 focus as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Barbara. I'll now pass on the word to Lucas first and then to Paulo. Please.
Yes, thanks. I had two relatively brief questions. The first one was, how do you deal with data issues, especially in the first part when you were talking about creating the different indices, given that missing data might be non-random missing data? So how do you deal with that? And then secondly, how do you respond to, like, or do you see a trade-off between having certain countries that are fairly low in their scores, but where you think that that's endogenous to some burdens that might also prevent you from having a large impact, or might make projects more difficult, whereas maybe if you have certain countries which rank in the middle of these indices, potentially that impact might be larger because the context is more conducive.
And now, Paulo, please.
Yes, thank you, Barbara, for the presentation. My question is about blended finance, and I'm very happy that you brought out the AAA rating, in the sense that sometimes, and I'm guessing this is also a problem for the EBRD, big development banks cannot engage with really risky clients and risky markets in this blended finance idea of really creating markets. So I was wondering if you could talk a minute or two about maybe the use of guarantees. I know the EBRD is using some guarantees, and how big corporations can really engage in those markets that are more fragile and more difficult to make business and still be profitable, because there's a bunch of regulations that might impede going the extra mile where it's most needed.
Thank you, Paulo. Please, Barbara.
Okay. So the questions from Lucas about data issues and missing data. I mean, yes, we have that issue all the time. With gender, actually, it's I have to say comparatively better compared to youth. Or if you start looking at disability, it gets really hard. I mean, there's not even an international definition of what is disability. We look at the data that we have, and we try to build the indices that we have. Very often we also use other indices that have already been established, such as Women Business and Deloitte, the OECD SIGI index, FinDex, etc. I'm not entirely sure what was your question. How do we deal with missing data? You will have seen that sometimes in our index there was a blank. We leave it blank. I mean, if we don't get enough country coverage, or if the quality of the data is insufficient, then we just can't use it.
Just maybe additionally, I just wanted to say that the idea behind this is you measure what you want to measure. So given that there might not be enough data, the reason behind it could well be that it's intentionally not being measured. So therefore, the countries that are actually the worst off are maybe the ones that you don't, and we don't have data on.
Yeah, I think there is an element to that. We can only measure what we have data for. So there can be gaps in what would be essential to be measured that we cannot measure because we don't know. Absolutely. So at the moment, for example, we're trying to figure out, we're trying to understand whether our Women in Business program actually have an impact, or whether, frankly, if these women just access plain vanilla SME lines, would their experience be the same? So to what extent do women-led SMEs benefit from the additional advisory and those sort of targeted products or not? Does that actually make a difference? It's very hard to find that data. So we are actually, our Office of the Chief Economist is looking at randomized controlled trials to work with one client to then work with one set of sub clients to see what we can find. But it's not something that, well, we will see to what extent we can extrapolate from that, but it's not something that we can run throughout. Or the very thorny questions of jobs. I mean, you see, I think more or less most development organizations reporting, we have created so and so many jobs. I mean, that's data that is really, really hard to get. And the attribution question is enormous. And so we've actually decided not to do this at all. But it also means we don't know. But we also don't pretend to know. So you know, there are trade-offs. There are limits to what you can do, and I'm sure there are areas where we don't target quite the right things because we don't know about them. So, and that also, in a way, comes to your question about the trade-off. You know, to what extent is the size of the gap only one side of the coin? You know, it's also about the environment that you work in. Absolutely, I think that's. I mean, hopefully the size of the gap should capture that broader environment as well, because we also look at social norms and the impact of social norms, for example, on opportunities beyond what is the letter of the law and so forth. But yes, I mean, no analytical system, I think, will be always completely watertight and able to capture this. We do have, I think the good thing with EBRD is we actually have offices in all of our countries of operation, sometimes more than one, sometimes three, four, five. You know, we have large numbers of people from that country working for us who are there on the ground, who know what's happening, who can see the opportunities and maybe spot the discrepancy in a better way. And then we can take that into consideration when we look at projects. In relation to blended finance, that's again a very important question. So to take the example of our SME lending and lending to women entrepreneurs, we do provide risk guarantees. We provide first loss risk covers in particular that allow the partner financial institutions to explore these new market segments, to go into new regions also, to develop new products and services, and to have a cover should that not work out. So the combination of providing the technical assistance to build their capacity, but also to provide the blended finance, particularly in relation to first loss risk cover, is an important area that we focus on. The question is always, how do you calibrate that? How do you know what level is the right level? And how do you know when it is no longer needed? So that's, I don't think we've cracked it, to be perfectly honest. It's something that we are looking at on an ongoing basis. This question basically, at what point does the market actually turn? And the risk cover is no longer needed in relation to a particular target group or a particular product, but of course also in relation to the overall riskiness of a country. At what point is that reduced or does it increase actually? So it's these assessments that, I mean, on a country basis, we have of course our regional economic prospects. And so we look at the political context, we look at the economic context. But in relation to individual investments and sometimes in the individual sort of types of impact we want to achieve, it's quite a complicated assessment.
Thank you, Barbara. Now it's the turn for Crystal and Fernanda, please.
Thank you again for sharing your time this evening. It's really interesting. I had two questions. The first was, you had said that you get what you incentivize. So I wanted mm-hmm. to know, how did the EBRD incentivize gender mainstreaming internally? So I'm really curious about that process. And I appreciate you kind of openly sharing some of the challenges that have been faced there. And then I also wanted to ask about gender, and if there's been any discussion about expanding the definition to be more inclusive of gender identity and looking at non-binary identities, and how that does or could play out in your work in the future.
Mm-hmm. Please, Barbara. Thank you.
Oh, should I not take the second one?
Ah, sorry. Yes, I. No, it's turn of Fernanda. Sorry, Fernanda.
No, it's okay. Thank you, Vanessa. Thank you. No, it's okay. And thank you, Barbara. It has been really fascinating to listen to you. I was going to ask something very similar to Lucas, so I want to follow up on that, if it's okay. Because I have been like encountering this part of like the gender data gap. So I was very impressed of having the look at your index. So it's has this built some or enhanced some capability for the countries to start generating this sex disaggregated data since it started, or how has that like overcome over the years, or how can you how can countries start doing this data? Because from what you were saying, you measure what you have, but also we need to start measuring what we don't have to be able to improve over time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do we incentivize gender mainstreaming? So initially, the first approach was to build both gender and economic inclusion into the bank's transition mandate. So that was that big, discussion we had with the board in 2013, where we then established that one of the sources of transition impact can be inclusive, and in that context can be gender. And therefore, if a project achieves impact in this area, it will receive a certain score. That goes into the banking scorecard in the sense that each banking team and each regional team has a scorecard with the sort of total score that they have to achieve. So that in a way creates an incentive. The problem, of course, is you can also achieve that score focusing on another quality. It doesn't have to be gender or inclusive. So there is this competition element that we still have. In order to incentivize mainstreaming beyond that, we just introduced a scorecard target that is separate from the transition impact target. So we have for the first time a standalone gender scorecard target that incentivizes banking teams to develop projects that have either got a gender transition impact or where gender is integrated into a project, but where gender is not the priority rationale for that project to happen. So this is something we call gender additionality. So gender is there, but the project actually focuses, say, on green and, I don't know, competitive, but the gender element is still in there, and is still, there is an indicator, we measure the impact, and it's therefore receives this gender smart tag. So this really has been a step change and a game changer in the whole thing, allowing us to basically create an incentive to not just for those banking teams who have an interest or, you know, who are particularly willing, but for everybody, because it's in everybody's scorecard for all the teams, for all the regions. And that really is has made a huge difference. We will see how it goes. I mean, it's only been introduced this year. We've certainly seen a huge increase in the first half of the year. But we will see how far along that line towards the 40% that we want to achieve we get. In relation to non-binary and sort of defining gender more broadly, this is something that we are now looking at as part of the new gender strategy, is the updated gender strategy that we are going to launch later this year, to in a way have a more inclusive definition of gender, and also a more fluid one, to really, ensure that we capture as wide in a way a definition as we possibly can, and work with our countries of operation and with our clients also in this context. So no longer talk about men and women, but really keep the language also adjusted to a broader definition here. On sex disaggregated data, I think that's a very good point. I mean, that is an important focus of our policy engagement now, where we work particularly with financial regulators, but not only, but particularly with them in Central Asia, actually, in including in Uzbekistan, but also in countries such as Egypt, on introducing and building their capacity to be able to collect sex disaggregated data and then to use it to make informed policy choices. So in Uzbekistan, for example, actually, we are one of the policy reforms that we're looking at is for as part of their compliance with the regulations and the regulatory framework for lenders, so for partner financial, for all financial institutions to have to report on the gender breakdown of their sub-lendings. This is something that has been started in the UK. It's on a voluntary basis at the moment, but we're looking at actually introducing that on a regulatory basis in parts of Central Asia. And also we're talking to the Egyptian authorities in this context as well. So it's about enhancing the availability of sex disaggregated data. And then the next step is, of course, is the use, you know, to actually use that data in order to inform policy choices. But it's an important area for us in relation to capacity building. We're working with Women's World Banking, for example, who support and provide training and capacity building to regulators in this context to show them the value of sex disaggregated data, why this is important and so forth. We're working with the Alliance for Financial Inclusion, AFI, I don't know if you know them. There's this whole sort of Maya Declaration, etc., building again capacity and also commitments on the part of central banks and regulators to focus on sex disaggregated data. So we are supporting our countries of operation and also our clients in this context. But I think it's an important contribution that we can make as an MDB, and we are also liaising or we're part of this Women's Entrepreneurship Finance Initiative. So that has been launched by the World Bank. And so working very closely with the IFC, the African Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and all the others on actually expanding that focus, coordinating that focus across a much broader region. Yeah.
Thank you so much. And finally, Manuela, please.
Thank you, Vanessa, and thank you so much, Barbara, for this very interesting presentation. I had just one really quick question. And you mentioned that for working in these inclusion plans the bank have, you go and revise like the business plan of the institution you're working with or the organization. And I mean, it makes sense because you have to ensure they will continue on this. But I was just wondering if there's like any approach to go beyond those businesses that are not already considering some kind of inclusion or equity improvement, because I guess they reach out and they have already this within their business plans in a sense, and it's like a reinforcing strategy, but maybe there are some other business that are not thinking about gender inclusion or disability or something, and it might be interesting to reach out to them. Thank you.
I think that's completely spot on. And this is exactly, in a way, what we do. EBRD is very clear that our impact has, well, there are three things we have to do with every investment we have to do. It has to be sound banking, so we can't lose money because fundamentally we need to get the repayment so we can reinvest. So if we're losing bank, then soon we're not going to have any money. So it has to be a sound banking project. It has to achieve transition impact. And it has to show financial and non-financial additionality. What that means is that there has to be a reason for EBRD to do this. If somebody else could do it, they should. And we look at the delta. We don't look at people who are already good at something and then we, in a way, reward them and give them more money to do more of what they're already doing very well. We're looking at those that are doing something not very well. So if I have a client who already has fabulous equal opportunities programs in place, who you know is a beacon of gender equality, that's great for them, but it's actually not very good for me because that's not a client I want to work with. So very different to some other approaches that other organizations may have, who say, we want to reward these clients, we want to sort of invest more and sort of encourage this sort of behavior. For EBRD, it's the other way around. We look at those that have never thought about, say, gender equality, or who have never thought about hiring people with disability, where the gap is the largest, because the way our incentive system works is that if you find a large gap, ideally in a country where the gap is also large, you can get the best rating possible. If you find a company that already employs 50% women, your rating is going to be minimal, because what's the value added? So it's that focus on additionality, I think that is very important. And that is a fundamental basic for EBRD. So I think that doesn't always mean that we succeed, as I mentioned earlier, because some of these clients may say, well, you know what, we've never thought about gender equality, but we also don't want to think about it now. But at the same time, we can work with clients over time, particularly if it's repeat clients, and start to sensitize them, start to sort of build their capacity, and over time actually turn them into companies or even promoters for gender equality in their sector. So we can really take them on a journey, but we focus on those that need that support, that need that awareness raising, rather than the stars.
Thank you, Barbara. This has been really fascinating, and it only remains for me to thank you. And it was really a great session that we all very much enjoyed. And see you next time.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you for your very good questions. And hopefully see you again sometime.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.